The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York with an original in-depth investigative report, your host, Gary Knoll.
Tonight, Ann Coulter has a new column out today about the nuke situation in Japan, and here she is. The column is entitled, A Glowing Report on Radiation. Glowing radiation, very, very good. But you are not down on radiation poisoning.
Well, it's not me. I'm citing a stunning number of physicists. And from the New York Times and the Times of London, there's a growing body of evidence that radiation in excess of what the government says are the minimum amounts right. You should be exposed to are actually good for you and reduce cases of cancer. The New York Times science section, for example, a few years ago reported on a study from Canada where all these women who had tuberculosis got an inordinate number of chest x-rays. Well, their breast cancer rate was lower than the general population. There were apartments put up in Taiwan in 1993 that accidentally contained an inordinate amount of cobalt-60, a radioactive substance. After 16 years, 10,000 occupants of these buildings being hit with five times what the government says is the minimum amount you should be hit with. The number of cancer cases they had, there were about 10,000 occupants, was only five cases. Now, for the general population in that same age group, a group of 10,000 Taiwanese should have gotten about 170 cases
of cancer.
So why,
if those things have happened, why isn't the established medical organizations or establishment saying that, you know, some kind of radiation can ward off infections? Why aren't they saying?
Well, they are. They're not getting a lot of media attention for it. This guy, the coolest cat in my column, is this Bernard Cohen at the University of Pittsburgh. He did a study of 90% of the counties in the U.S., and he looked at levels of radon, radioactive substance from the earth, and lung cancer rates. And they were inversely related so dramatically that it couldn't be explained by
some
cigarette
radiation
smoke.
In the body acts as an agent to ward off cancer.
That's what many scientists believe. As the New York Times science section has reported, it doesn't get pressed because...
So by your account, we should all be...
And so it goes. Now we have Bill O'Reilly and Ann Coulter holding forth on why we actually would benefit from low-level radiation and excess radiation, helping women actually prevent breast cancer. And Professor Cohen, who I filmed... And will be in a new documentary on this as being correct. Except they're not. I challenged Cohen's research on yesterday's program. Beginning in our program today, I wish to challenge the idea that low-level radiation is safe or even beneficial. I will also challenge the idea that the old science model, that if you're exposed to something and you do not get sick immediately, that obviously then there is no risk, when it may take 40 or 50 years after exposure to any element to manifest a toxic reaction in your body, especially cancer. And we will not have Ann Coulter as our expert. We will have arguably the world's greatest outspoken scientist, physician on the subject, nuclear physicist, and one of the actual members, the original members of our atomic energy program in the United States, Dr. John Gottman. We also have Dr. Ernest Sternglass, a PhD in nuclear physics, University of Pittsburgh. We will also have Professor Jay Gould, who Dr. Gould is arguably one of the finest minds that in the United States on the effects of low-level radiation and things you do not think about that is not being discussed. What happens when you live near a nuclear facility? You don't hear of any problems. Where do you think that the outgassing goes? It can go into the water supply. And we're using one example, the Columbia River. Well, what happens if you eat fish from the Columbia River or your drinking water for your municipality comes from the Columbia River? What if the radiation goes into the ground and goes into an underground aquifer? Is there anyone measuring for that? Is there any way of getting the radioactivity out of it? We hear of the low-level impact of radiation on the thyroid gland and being gone in 8 days. What about the other radiation that is also in the same plume, the same air that you're breathing that will last 27,000 years in your body? Why aren't we told the whole truth? Why aren't we told of the high incidence of cancer around nuclear facilities? Why aren't we told about all the deaths of infants who were born underweight and therefore had a higher death rate than normal weight babies by being exposed to nuclear fission products, not only in the United States, but also around Chernobyl? The pro-nuclear industry has controlled the debate. The American media has accepted the scientists coming forward to speak on behalf of, don't worry, there's not a problem, as the ultimate experts. They are not. We then offer you strong minds with very substantial science and scholarship, not just opinions, to back up their points of view.
Japan has the same terrible trouble as we have. They have 50 nuclear reactors in an area the size of California, and cancer was low and flat all the way since 1900, then rose after Hiroshima, and then more after the bomb ended and the nuclear reactors replaced the bomb fallout. The myth behind nuclear energy is that there is no serious effect on human health from the operation of nuclear plants. And unfortunately, that has been a deception because it was necessary for the government in the early years of the development of nuclear weapons to have nuclear power as a potential for the good aspect, the happy aspect of the atom. And therefore, when the government was detonating over 100 nuclear bombs in the atmosphere and 800 underground, they wanted the public to believe that this was not harmful, because they were needed, absolutely, at the time of the Cold War. And so it became necessary to deny that small amounts of releases from nuclear plants, which are unavoidable, are really harmless. When we began to understand that we made such a mistake was shortly after Dr. Alice Stewart in England in the 1957, 58, 60, had discovered that one or two X-rays would significantly increase the chance that a child would develop cancer if this X-ray were taken of the mother during the end of pregnancy. And that was only became known at the end of the 1950s, long after the first bombs were detonated, you see. And I happened to be reading her article at a time when we were having new children, babies born, and I was very concerned because everyone was being told at the end of the 50s, we need to build bomb shelters. And it was this combination of the fear of a nuclear war, the desire to protect our babies, and finding out about Dr. Alice Stewart's findings that only a few X-rays double the risk of having a child that will develop leukemia or cancer before age 10, that began to persuade a few scientists like myself and a few others that we must not go ahead with exposing people to low-level radiation, that we had underestimated the effect on human beings by factors of 10 to 100 times, because a child, the early infant and the fetus in the mother's womb, is so much more sensitive than the adult. And so the entire Earth is affected by every release of extremely fine radioactive particles or gases that are radioactive and which decay into the major serious substances like strontium-90 and radioactive iodine, which then get into the food chain and are inhaled or ingested with the water, the vegetables, or the milk. And in fact, milk turns out to be the way it is mostly transported from around the nuclear plant into our bodies, because we are urged to drink milk, and the nuclear plants were placed near the dairies, and the dairy farms are located where the milk is needed, near the big cities, and you know, near Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, New York City, and so we unfortunately transport it to large distances, and that is what we didn't understand.
We do know that many physicians are ignorant concerning the biological effects of ingested fission products. The entire media seems to be complicit in this ignorance. As the Cold War that spawned the nuclear arms race with the attendant need for secrecy ended, the long-hidden story of the enormous effects of nuclear weapons production and testing that has devastated U.S. health and productivity can finally be told. But it isn't being told. Moreover, without a nuclear threat from a dismembered Soviet Union, we can now hope that a new generation of political leaders and scientists and physicians and public health officials will be able to face the tragic facts emerging from the studies of the millions exposed to the fallout from Chernobyl and other large releases dating back as far as 1944. But it's imperative that in the enormous rise in the incidence of low birth weight and cancer, now driving the cost of health care and threatening so many people's lives, we now know from declassified documents that in 1945, in the rush to produce plutonium for the initial atomic bombs detonated in 1945, 555 trillion picocuries of radioactive iodine were released into the biosphere from the Hanford Nuclear Weapons Complex in Washington. We also now know that there was an immediate increase in the percentage of underweight births as far away as New York State. This phenomenon began in 1945 and accelerated rapidly with the first atomic bomb explosions by the United States and USSR in the following years, and reached peak levels in the mid-1960s, along with the corresponding peaks in strontium-90 levels measured in human bones. And keep in mind, contrary to what Ann Coulter or others would like you to believe, once strontium-90 and other radioactive material fission products are in your bone, it will defect your bone marrow. It can defect the proper production of white blood cells, B cells, and stem cells, therefore precipitating autoimmune diseases and failed immune systems, which we now had at epidemic levels. After declining from its highest levels after the atmospheric test ban became the law 40 years ago, within the last 15 years, the percentage of low birth weight babies is rising again in the U.S., and we are now experiencing an unprecedented rise in the number of people requiring medical care and disability payments at the state and federal level. Now, recent studies now suggest that one hitherto neglected factor is the unexpectedly severe biological action of radioactive releases from aging nuclear reactors into the milk and water supplies that Dr. Sternglass just mentioned around every major metropolitan area in the United States. And these releases act as a secondary insult to the immune systems, initiating damaged immune systems. We have assembled 9 major exhibits, which will be posted on ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com later today, that document completely the unexpectedly large effects produced by inhaled or ingested nuclear fission products on the immune system, leading to premature birth, to low birth weight, and renewed rises in infectious diseases and cancer, as first anticipated and predicted by Professor Andrei Sokurov in 1958 and recounted in Chapter 14 of his memoirs. The biological mechanisms involved was discovered in 1971 by Dr. Adam Petka, a physician trained in biophysics working for the Canadian Atomic Energy Establishment in Pinawa, Manitoba. He performed a simple experiment on a lipid membrane that completely overturned conventional ideas on the biological damage produced by extremely low levels of radiation. All the research and experience of the scientific and medical community since the discovery of X-rays and radioactive materials just before the turn of the century did not warn us of the seriousness of low doses of radiation from internally deposited fission products. As explained in the as explained in the Petkow effect, the successful experience with the medical uses of X-rays without side effects convinced the nuclear scientists who developed the atomic bomb and its principal effects would be produced by blasts and fire. No one thought about fallout, or drifting radioactive fallout would be a problem miles away, let alone states away, let alone a continent away. No one believed that these would have any impact. If you did not have an impact from the blast and the fire, you were safe. But wasn't the case. Far below the levels of background radiation from cosmic rays, natural sources, and diagnostic X-rays, and we had all this other biologically active fissionable products being released by nuclear facilities. Petkow's discovery was first published in March 1972 in the issue of Health Physics under the innocuous title Effect of Na22 on Phospholipid Membrane. In it, he describes how he found that cell membranes immersed in water, which were able to withstand X-ray doses as large as hundreds to thousands of rads without breaking down, ruptured at less than one rad when subjected to low-intensity protracted radiation such as that produced by radioactive salts immersed in water. In effect, low-level radiation, actually to your body, does extreme harm over a period of time. This finding was completely contrary to all previous observations of biological damage by radiation, such as genetic effects and cancer induced in laboratory animals or humans, which had shown almost no dependence on the rate at which radiation is delivered to the tissues. Now, as Petkow and his associates discovered, the cell membrane damage due to low-level radiation was a result of a completely different biological mechanism than the direct hit on the DNA molecules in the nucleus of cells exposed to high doses of radiation. They found that the cell membranes were destroyed by the action of negatively charged oxygen molecules or free radicals produced by the absorbed radiation from the life-giving oxygen dissolved in the surrounding fluid. This highly toxic form of oxygen diffused to the outer surface of the membrane, where it initiated a chain reaction that dissolved the membrane in a matter of minutes to hours, causing the cells to leak and die. So it became clear that a single free radical molecule was sufficient to destroy an entire cell, so that only a handful was needed to produce per cell volume at very low dose rates. At very high dose rates, many millions would be formed in the same volume in the lifetime of the molecule. This results in a form of overkill, much like the case of a balloon, where one single dart is all that's necessary to pop the balloon. So you throw 10 million darts, you're not going to get any more of a popping. It's just wasteful. In fact, the more free radicals are created in a given volume as from higher levels of radiation intensity, the more they tend to collide with each other, causing them to become deposited in living tissue, and high doses, given at the rate of 10,000 rads per minute, were found to be 1 billion times less efficient in destroying a cell than at 1 10 millionth of a rad per minute, the rate at which we experience background radiation. So Ann Calder and everyone else is dead wrong. And what really is incredible to me is someone who could be so irresponsible is putting women's lives at risk by giving this flippant notion, completely anti-intellectual, anti-science, and anti-caring for women's bodies, that you could have more cancer, more disease caused by low-level background radiation than you could from the big blast. And so what do? We look for the big blast. And hence everything else is considered acceptable. Oh, don't worry about the radiation clouds coming into California. It's acceptable. Don't worry about all of our 104 nuclear reactors in the United States that give off radiation into the air and fissionable products on a daily basis. It's acceptable. To whom is it acceptable? Are you going to be morally and legally responsible, Ann Coulter and Bill O'Reilly and Fox Network, for the disinformation? My God, I thought I'd taken a trip back in time to the anti-Darwin Scopes trial. Have we regressed that far in our society? The consequence of the enormously greater efficiency of internal radiation at low dose rates is that the dose response curve rises very rapidly at the small doses and dose rates near background radiation and flattens out at higher doses and dose rates, so that the risk per unit dose declines with increasing dose rates. Thus, we have what appears to be a perverse situation in which low-dose radiation, protracted over periods of days, months, or years, are far more dangerous per unit of absorbed radiation than high doses of external resources. And mathematically, this turns out to be the form of a concave, downward, or logarithmic relation between dose and the biological response for individuals exposed to different amounts of radiation during a given time period, as in the case of releases into the environment that enter the diet and concentrate in critical organs such as the bone marrow and the thyroid and the pituitary gland. Thus, the so-called Petkau effect, that's P-E-T-K-A-U, explains why man-made fission products such as strontium-90 concentrate in the bone, introduced into a pristine biosphere in the earliest years of the nuclear age, did so much more damage to the immune system cells than had been believed possible based upon the experience of medical x-rays or the study of animals exposed to high radiation doses. Now, the damage to the immune system of young women of childbearing age leads both to a higher risk of pelvic inflammation and a greater likelihood of immunological rejection of the fetus as a foreign body, thus producing a rise in premature and underweight births or abortions. And that's about 1 in 3 miscarriages, where the body rejects it, or you end up with a dead fetus. Did anyone ever ask why we have such an astronomically, statistically high number of rejects? Moreover, the fission produce bone-seeking isotopes such as strontium-90 and 89 emit powerful beta rays with a large enough range to reach the marrow where the cells of the immune system originate, making them far more toxic than the naturally occurring radium, which emits heavy alpha particles of such short range that most of them remain in the bone. In summary, we have found that the most immediate biological effects of the introduction of man-made fission products into the environment was an enormous increase in miscarriages and the birth of premature and underweight infants at high risk of birth defects and subsequent neurological, hormonal, and immunological problems. This problem was most acute in the atmosphere bomb test years, when the U.S. and USSR exploded the equivalent of 40,000 Hiroshima bombs, according to the National Resource Defense Council, but it has continued as a result of reactor accidents and large daily releases due to cracking of fuel elements and corrosion of health exchangers. These problems are compounded by another effect of fallout that Sakharov anticipated in 1958, namely the increased mutation rates of microorganisms, which in greater effect end up causing massive problems. And recent articles in Science magazine delineate the enormous public health crisis set off by the increasing resistance of antibiotics of those mutating microorganisms responsible for advanced cases of AIDS, tuberculosis, shigellosis, salmonella, toxic shock syndrome, Lyme's disease, and many other newly emerging or old infections. Thus, in addition to causing immune deficiency, fission products at low levels would accelerate the mutation rate of microorganisms, leading to a new epidemic or epidemics on a worldwide basis and new strains that would be far more deadly. As we have shown, repeatedly in articles that there is no such thing as a safe level of radiation. According to Dr. R.K. White, a professor of pediatrics, he stated that first-day neonatal death since 1935, a re-examination of the cross hypothesis, that was the title of the article, and he found that falling rates of neonatal and first-day infant death since 1935 was stopped when we started detonating bombs. And the hypothesis of the observed infant death could be attributed to restrictions of oxygen for premature infants was ruled out by the fact that the same rise and decline occurred for stillborns, and only fallout could account for the excess. Even more sensitive indicator of the damage to the developing fetus is the increase in the percentage of live birth weights less than 5.5 pounds. In Upper New York State, this percentage rose from 6% in 1945 to an all-time peak of 8% in 1966 when the radioactive strontium buildup in the bones of New Yorkers also reached an all-time peak. And since 1945, 13 million underweight babies have been born in the United States. And for New York City, the decline is seen to have halted in the early 70s, but rose sharply after 1985. Now, the causal link of the rise of low birth weights to fission products is dramatically illustrated, as indicated by a 70% rise in Nevada in 1951 in the low birth rate percentages when above-ground testing began at the Nevada test site, and winds carried radiation clouds over Las Vegas. And while later more care was taken to avoid densely populated Las Vegas, the low birth weight percentage in Nevada remained above average until well after testing was shifted underground after 1963. And we might note the recent rise in U.S. low birth weights, especially for non-whites, which can be attributed to increased underground tests and fallout from Chernobyl and U.S. reactors. Now, also an indication, the official national the Regulatory Commission data shows that civilian power reactors to the period 1970 to 87 released into the atmosphere 370 curies or 370 trillion picocuries of radioactive iodine and strontium and cesium and other fission products. This amounts to 1.7 million picocuries for every person in the United States. So the next time someone tells you on television, our plants are safe, we don't emit any problem radiation, they are being disingenuous or dishonest with intent, because the evidence shows just the opposite. And that's official evidence. Where does it go? It goes into the grass, goes into what the cows eat, the grass, which goes into their milk, it goes into the cheese, it goes into the fruits and vegetables. Also, we have shown that since civilian nuclear power reactors are largely concentrated in New England, Middle Atlantic, and East North Central regions, per capita releases of radioactive iodine, strontium, and others in these regions is 25 times greater than in the three regions that have only a few reactors, namely the 16 states in the mountain and eastern central, west central regions. And we show that these have relatively non-nuclear regions, there are statistically significant lower rates of cancer, including breast cancer. Well, why is it that a person would have less breast cancer living in Montana and more breast cancer living on Long Island, if all other things have been equal? Smoking incidents, alcohol incidents, exposure to sunlight, if all those things are equal, what is the one difference? Well, how about the closeness to a nuclear facility? Also, 1985 and 86, the Indian Point reactors close to New York released 14 curies of iodine-131 and other fission products, as did Three Mile Island in 1979. And while the Millstone reactors had equally large releases in the 1970s, the Indian Point releases may have sufficiently contaminated the nearby reservoirs to explain the recent distribution of these low birth weights after 1985. Remember, once something's in the soil, many of these things will stay for thousands of years, the same in aquifers. You just don't wash out the water, and it's clean again. The epidemic rise of breast cancer incidence in Connecticut and Long Island can be shown to be highly correlated with the emissions from Millstone beginning in 1970. And again, after the start of large reactor releases in the early 1970s and since 1979 Three Mile Island accident, breast cancer incident rates have soared along with the incident rates of all other types of female and prostate cancers, just about 7 to 9 years after the large releases from Three Mile Island. And death rates have increased less rapidly thanks to advances in diagnosis therapy. But it's clear that the real explosion of the medical costs of treating cancer associated with the rising trend in cancer incidence. And we have looked at all of the age-adjusted breast cancer death rates, and as calculated by the National Cancer Institute for each state, and weighed them to secure averages for each of the 9 census regions, and then correlated them with the log values of per capita releases to radioactive iodine and strontium for each region. And guess what? The correlation is seen to be very high and could not be produced by chance. And for a good example of the Petkoff effect, the risk per unit dose is seen to be the highest at low doses. So breast cancer incidence in Connecticut for the years 1935-1979, taken from the Connecticut Tumor Registry, and here we have fitted a straight line to the breast cancer incidence for women 50 to 74 from 1935-1970, just before the Hadman, Neck, and Millstone reactors began operations. And the extraordinary upward divergence since 1970 from the trend line has never been explained. Counties most affected include nearby Middlesex and New London, along with Nassau and Suffolk counties, directly opposite the Millstone nuclear reactor, all having the highest breast cancer death rates in the nation, exceeding even that of New York City. So I'm concluding that the data presented indicate that it is unacceptable to have these fission products released into the environment. And all you have to do is look at the last 55 years of these releases, known and unknown, and neither the medical profession, the hospitals, nor the pharmaceutical industry is responsible for these low birth weights and the rise in the number of individuals with weakened immune systems and the high rate of mutations of microorganisms that's increasingly resistant to antibiotics and other drugs contribute then all to the physiopathology of new infections and the resurgence of other immune system-related diseases that we're now seeing. And since the rise in poor health also reduces human productivity, better understand what this means for people who believe that there is no big deal. Didn't a scientist, didn't an expert in radiological sciences like Bill O'Reilly? We have nothing to worry about. Yeah, we do.
Well, you have to understand that low-level radiation does not refer to background radiation. Background radiation from natural causes represents a problem that humankind has lived with for millions of years. And we have developed an immune system over that time that can resist mutant cells if that immune system is functioning well. But since 1945, we have introduced into the biosphere man-made fission products that never existed in nature before. And when these are ingested, they concentrate in certain organs of the body, and some of them, like the strontium, will stay in the body for your lifetime. Others, like radioactive iodine, has a short half-life. Those remain in your body for, say, 10 days. But in that time, they can set up some very worrisome damage. And in the case of iodine, most of the damage goes to the fetal thyroid if it ingested by a pregnant woman. In the case of strontium 90, it goes to the bone marrow. And that, of course, is a very effective way to weaken the immune system. Now, the proof that man-made fission products exerts this lethal impact can be obtained from the official vital statistics available in the United States. We have a magnificent system of collecting the vital statistics, but not a system of looking at it. And one of the things that I and Joe Mangano, who works with me as an epidemiologist, kind of epidemiological detective, I would say, is to get into the official data and demonstrate what has happened over the past 50 years of nuclear contamination. And probably I'd like to focus on two particular documents, documented epidemiological anomalies. Probably the most important one, as an indication of what has happened, is this. New York State is the only state in the Union that measured birth weight of live births as far back as 1945. 1945, as you know, is the first year of the nuclear age. And in that year, 1945, the percentage of live births in New York State that weighed, that was underweight, weighing under 5.5 pounds, was 6.5%. And from 1945 for the next 20 years, right through the middle of the 60s, during the period of atmospheric bomb tests, that low birth weight percentage rose by nearly 40%, from 6.5% of all live births in 1945 to 9% in 1965. I was talking about one of the major epidemiological anomalies of the nuclear age, namely the fact that in the first 20 years, from 1945 to 1965, this is a period, by the way, in which the atmospheric bomb tests were equivalent to exploding something like 40,000 Hiroshima bombs. So the fallout from that nuclear orgy has produced, in the very first instance, this enormous increase in the percentage of underweight babies born from 1945 to 1965, a 40% increase in the low birth weight percentage. Now, what this means is that in this period, there are about 60 million baby boomers born, that is, in the first, from 1945 to 1965. So what this means is that a significant proportion of those babies were born at low birth weight, and we can trace the consequent impact on this generation thereafter. For example, one of the most interesting examples was that babies born in 1945 reached the age of 18 in 1963, and in 1963 there began a very troublesome decline in SAT scores, which my colleague, Dr. Ernest Sternglass, was the first to see was correlated, that decline was correlated with the bomb test 18 years earlier. And he was able to predict in 1979 that the SAT scores would go up in the 80s because the test would be taken by children who were born after the atmospheric bomb test had stopped in 1963. And that was exactly what has happened. At any rate, this is a kind of brief description of one impact of low-level radiation. But there's another that is even more surprising, in effect, and that is this. Connecticut is a state that has a tumor registry that began in 1935, the only one in the world that goes back that far. And in the Connecticut Tumor Registry, by the way, this is something that Joe Mangano first discovered, the incidence of breast cancer from 1935 to 1944, pre-nuclear, was declining. But in 1945, the first year of the nuclear age, when there was an enormous emission of radioactive iodine from Hanford, that the DOE now admits, because of that, there was a tremendous jump in the incidence of breast cancer, starting in 1945, continuing through 1970 at a rate of 2% a year. And then in 1970, with the opening of the very troublesome Millstone reactors on Long Island Sound, the incidence of breast cancer among women started to go up by 3% a year. So from 1945 to 1992, there was almost a threefold increase in the incidence of breast cancer. And that is so perfectly correlated with the emissions, with nuclear emissions, that in the absence of any alternative explanation, we have to assume that this had a lot to do with the breast cancer epidemic, particularly when you consider that in the 80s, when the incidence rate started to go up by 3% rather than 2%, it was now reflecting the incidence of breast cancer among baby boom women born after 1945.
Well, what I can talk about, Gary, are a couple of things that I've been researching in the last couple of years. The first is thyroid cancer. Obviously, radiation presents a potential risk for many different types of diseases, especially cancer. Thyroid cancer is one of the ones that's most frequently discussed in the medical literature, not because it's the most common cancer or the deadliest cancer. It's not. But because all agree that ionizing radiation presents a risk of thyroid cancer. And this is primarily because of radioactive iodine, which is one of the products that we see in atomic bomb testing or in emissions from nuclear reactors, which when you ingest it, whether it's through the milk or water or vegetables, goes right to the thyroid gland and goes through the process of destroying thyroid cells or impairing thyroid cells. This is totally agreed on. The question is how much iodine is needed to damage the thyroid and to cause thyroid cancer. This is something that's less agreed upon. So this is what my research has gotten into. For years, there have been a lot of reports in the medical literature on thyroid cancer in populations exposed to radiation, the Hiroshima Nagasaki survivors, people who lived in the Marshall Islands where they tested bombs in the 40s and 50s, and people who lived in Utah, very close to where the Nevada bomb testing occurred years ago. An exciting development, though, and just in the last couple of months, there's been a number of reports in the literature and in the lay press on a very sharp increase in thyroid cancer in children living near Chernobyl. In Belarus, for example, which is right next to Chernobyl and directly downwind from the period before the accident in 86 to the early 1990s, only about 5 years after the explosion, there's been a 100 times increase in the rate of childhood thyroid cancer. That's like a 10,000% increase. In the Ukraine, which is also next to Chernobyl, only upwind, there's been a 7 times increase, like a 700% increase. These are massive increases, and they're large numbers, too, where instead of just one or two so cases a year in each of these republics, we're seeing, you know, 50 to 80 cases a year.
Dr. Goffman, would you please tell us about the relationship between breast cancer and irradiation? Is there an incubation time for radiation-induced breast cancer?
Yes, and that incubation time is the thing that led organized medicine exactly in the wrong direction for at least 50 out of the last 100 years. Medicine at the turn of the century in 1910, 1920, 30, 40 regarded something this way. If you gave some poison and you saw an effect, it would be in weeks or months. They did not think in terms of years or decades. What we have learned about X-ray-induced cancer is that there are a few cases, a very small proportion, that occur in the first few years after the X-rays are administered. But most of them take 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years at least. And it may even be that some appreciable proportion show up after 50 years from the radiation. So as we look at the problem today, women, for example, are saying, I'm 45 or I'm 55 or I'm 60 and I haven't done anything wrong and here I am with a breast cancer. What those women are not thinking about is the fact that in 1940, 41 and 42, there's a chapter in the book Preventing Breast Cancer, pediatricians in New York City, in Rochester, in the Pacific Northwest, were giving children fluoroscopic examination 12 times a year for the first 2 years as part of their well baby examination. Now, I'm not saying that all pediatricians did it, but the Pacific Northwest Association of Pediatricians had two lectures given to them by a health physicist and a radiologist saying, this is a bad idea. So with your statement, which is correct, Gary, the incubation time is long, those children in the first couple of years or few years of life who are getting fluoroscoped are the ones that laid the foundation for their developing breast cancer when they were 40, 50, 60, or even 70. And so now, in the last 25 years, we're seeing an awful lot of the results of what we did to children and to adults. The other thing is, I have just noticed over and over again with this, since I've been in this aspect of the work, women have contacted me and tell me this story that it gets repeated so many times, that they had an accident, an auto accident or some other accident, which resulted in an injury to their back, and they had x-rays after x-rays in the course of the treatment of their back. And some of these women are tragically coming down in their late 30s and 40s and 50s with breast cancer. So incubation time is everything. And if you really want to know the story about breast cancer today, you have to ask yourself what was being done 50 and 40 and 30 years ago.
Dr. John Goffman, in my opinion, the greatest scientist and the greatest voice for being honest and outspoken concerning the dangers of fissionable products and diagnostic x-rays. Now we have the argument that Indian Point, which is very close to where I'm at in our studio in New York City, it's safe. Yes, there might be a few little glitches, but nothing we should be concerned about. To the contrary, if there is an accident at Indian Point, you will not be able to escape its impact. There is no way we're going to get the people of New York and New Jersey and Connecticut out of harm's way. That means this plant should be closed down. I believe all nuclear facilities should be closed down. I will deal with that on an upcoming program, but Professor Michio Kaku has some specific thoughts on this and the idea that somehow we should separate out the problems that might occur from a nuclear facility that's just giving us electricity versus a nuclear facility that is making atomic weapons. And what about all those depleted uranium bombs and buster bombs that have gone off in Afghanistan that are going off today in Libya? What is the likelihood? Do you realize that with every one of the depleted bombs being used in, on those missiles in any country, we are permanently impacting the environment? The fissionable products, the most deadly of those, will stay for over 3 billion years. They'll be in the sand, the air, the water, and hence the food of all the people. This is how poorly thought through our thoughts are. We have created an environmental wasteland in Iraq, Afghanistan, now Pakistan, and now Yemen, and also in Libya. We have Professor Michio Kaku.
Driving the push for commercial nuclear energy. However, when you look at the history, you begin to realize that there have been many cover-ups, that there have been many scandals with regards to this technology. This technology is an unfinished technology, and yet it was rushed online back in the 50s and 60s because people saw super profits involved. As a consequence, many of the very important safety studies were kept under wraps. For example, in the 50s, the government did WASH 740, one of the most important studies on a major nuclear power plant accident, stating that you could contaminate up to 50,000 square miles of real estate if a small reactor were to have a gigantic Class 9 meltdown. That was kept under wraps because it would frighten people, realizing that you could contaminate an area comparable to the state of Pennsylvania. Some people say, look at Hiroshima. We cleaned that up, didn't we? Yeah, but you see, Hiroshima was an airburst. it had very little fallout because it didn't detonate on the ground. A nuclear power plant, on the other hand, has tremendous amounts of nuclear waste, that is then lofted into the atmosphere, unlike the Hiroshima bomb, which was detonated in the atmosphere, releasing a burst of gamma rays and neutrons. So in other words, the long-term consequences of a major Class 9 nuclear accident are forever. Super profits involved. As a consequence, many of the very important safety studies were kept under wraps. For example, in the 50s, the government did WASH 740, one of the most important studies on a major nuclear power plant accident, stating that you could contaminate up to 50,000 square miles of real estate if a small reactor were to have a gigantic Class 9 meltdown. That was kept under wraps because it would frighten people, realizing that you could contaminate an area comparable to the state of Pennsylvania.
They say they're going to mix the plutonium with uranium for MOX fuel, mixed oxide fuel, and put it in civilian power plants, which is terribly dangerous. If there's a meltdown, you get much more plutonium than you would just the 500 pounds released from an ordinary uranium-powered plant if you mix plutonium in with the uranium fuel. But actually, the hidden agenda is to create more bombs from the plutonium. This is really evil.
Right now, the president is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to research bunker-busting nuclear weapons. The United States is pursuing a new set of nuclear weapons. It doesn't make sense. You talk about mixed messages. We're telling other people you can't have nuclear weapons, but we're pursuing a new nuclear weapon that we might even contemplate using.
Not only are we not cutting nuclear weapons or making offers to negotiate down and work for nuclear weapons-free world, we are spending $6.5 billion a year on new nuclear weapons research and development, and we're talking about mini nukes that are more usable. We're talking about bunker busters that will be nuclear tipped. This is like insanity because it's a terrible threat to every other country on the planet. So they want to keep up with us. So we're fueling an arms race. And add to that our determination to weaponize space. That's very threatening to China and Russia because that means we have a first strike capacity and they have nothing to hit us back with. So we're going to start an arms race in space too.
Even as testing goes into cyberspace, even as testing goes into simulations, as we gear up for third generation hydrogen warheads. Third generation hydrogen warheads are designer hydrogen warheads. They're warheads that can go underground and knock out bunker positions. They're warheads that could be used in the jungle, in the desert, in the Arctic, and in outer space. These are designer hydrogen bombs, third generation bombs, to take the nuclear arms race into outer space and to take the nuclear arms race underground to knock out underground bunker positions with nuclear bombs to be dropped also over cities. Also, the plan to reduce nuclear weapons by two-thirds neglects the fact that these weapons are not going to be dismantled. We're not going to take them apart. We're going to simply stockpile them. They'll be placed in a cabinet so that on a moment's notice, we can rev up the nuclear arms race literally overnight. And so I support the reduction of any nuclear weapon. Even one nuclear bomb dismantled, I support. However, let's not fool ourselves. These plans to reduce the nuclear arsenal will simply shelve these nuclear weapons into a cabinet where they can be taken out on a moment's notice.
When we consider that during the first Gulf War in 1991 and the subsequent Gulf War, 2003, we have had several million American GIs exposed to depleted uranium. This is manifested, along with other contributing factors, including experimental vaccines, into what we call Gulf War Syndrome. More than 800,000 vets are now complaining of having illnesses known as Gulf War Syndrome. More than 70,000 have died. These statistics are the government's own statistics, yet they've received no attention. When you consider that bullets and the material that is used to penetrate tanks, shells, have been used by the thousands, then that radioactive material stays forever. And I believe that we have abrogated our responsibility in not identifying the real problems of depleted uranium, fissionable products, and their impact on human health. In fact, at one hospital near Fallujah, a physician gave our film crew, when we were filming there for a documentary on Gulf War Syndrome, a group of photos and says, please get this to the American media. I said, the American media will not publish these. These are deformities. Babies with cyclops heads, an eye in the middle of the head. Babies born with no brain in the skull. And these are happening at an astronomical rate. Depleted uranium and other toxic byproducts of the war. None of this has been a matter of conversation in the United States. This is also part of our nuclear policy. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you very much for listening today. Tomorrow, human guinea pigs.